I'm an addict named David.
Amen.
And it's pretty astounding. The fact that I'm up here to speak about the spiritual nature of this program is kind of interesting also. It has nothing to do with what I came here for, but I'll get to that in a minute. Before I go on, there's a couple of things I got to remember. I got a good friend in D.C. that was supposed to come up to see us today, and can't make it. Rico, he's a guy that helped me a lot, and I just wanted to say that part of who I am is a result of him and others that have helped me here. There are a lot of people in this room this morning that helped me, and there's just too many to name, so I'm just going to say you know who you are, and thank you so much. When I was unable to see what it was I had, you guys kept pointing that stuff out. Anyway, I'm a Washingtonian, son of a Washingtonian, and I've been around D.C. all my life, and most of my trouble was there. I did most of my time there. I grew up originally in Langley Park. My father was Jewish. My mother was Catholic. All the kids in my family made a commitment to our parents to go to 1 year of each school and then decide later about what to do. I did mine in the same year, so had, you know, for a year, Saturdays I'd go to Hebrew school, and Sundays I'd go to catechism class, and what I got from all of that was that there was really nothing for me in either of those places, and I skipped it most of the time. But early in my life, it became clear my mom, my mom was a falling down drunk, and I tried to tell everybody, I was very big on the idea that I was never going to be like her. So I did drugs instead. I played music in junior high and in high school, and I played in a band, and I was about a C-minus guitar player. But when it came time, I had gotten in trouble. My first felony was in 1967 when I was 16, and I could never seem to get off paper until from 16 to 34, I was either on parole or probation or in jail. That's an unbroken streak there, I should just say that when I got to the second or third meeting of Narcotics Anonymous, this guy named Al told me that he would guarantee me that if I could sleep 8 hours and work 8 hours and mind my own business 8 hours, he promised me I wouldn't get any more felonies, and I haven't gotten any more felonies since I came to Narcotics Anonymous. But I'm getting ahead of myself. I kept getting in trouble. I was a very dismal failure as a drug dealer. I thought I had it all worked out when I figured I could mail half my dope to myself, and that way I wouldn't do it all in one day. I went to jail for breaking into the mailbox, the whole bit. It was not fun. Anyway, I spent many years in rehabs. I went to nine. I went to three therapeutic communities. My first treatment was Second Genesis in Upper Marlboro, 301 Crane Highway. Yep. Wore a sign, shaved my head, the whole bit. I left there, AMA, of course. And then about 2 years later, I was at Rap House. I was the only white guy in that program. I learned a lot there too. We were at 14th and U, but the year I was there, we moved to Willard Street. But all of these places were good, and I'm sure I heard a lot of good stuff, but I just wasn't listening. I went to a number of other rehabs. I'm not going to go through all those six chapters because it's just too long, and it's just redundant because it was the same thing. My life's kind of been a mashup of Groundhog Day and The Wizard of Oz. Because I was doing the same thing over and over and over again, looking for something I had the whole time. And I just didn't know that, I couldn't see that. So anyway, long story short, I ended up in a cornfield in Paw Paw, West Virginia, in my car with a shotgun in my mouth. I mean, it's true. I was living with a girl, and we started out as partners in a cocaine distribution network, and then she decided to stop using. And we were living together, and I said, "You're gonna what?" And she said, "Well, that was fun, but it's time to grow up." And so for about 4 years, I kept telling her I was gonna stop around New Year's. I should tell you that I went away to school. It's a brief chapter in my life in New Mexico. I played guitar. I wanted to play like these guys that played the blues. That's all I ever wanted to do. And all of them shot heroin, every one of them. So I knew that I was not good enough because that's why I just needed to shoot heroin. So I went to New Mexico State. And I mean, it's stupid, I know, but I, I was 28 miles north of the Mexican border at Las Cruces, New Mexico, and I was there for about 8 months. And I came home, and I was near death from hepatitis and had a terrible habit. And so over the next year or two, I stopped shooting heroin, and I was just shooting cocaine. I was just doing it on the weekends, and I had a job, and I had a girlfriend. That first rehab I went to, after 6 months, if you were in there for heroin, they gave you drinking passes. I mean, that's how it was then. Things were a lot different then. And I must tell you, this conference is 31 years old now, and I just picked up my 31-year chip. Thank you. It's kind of appropriate that I've never done this. I've never spoken to this many people, and really never had ambitions to. And when they called me, I called my sponsor. Said that I think they made a mistake. And, but see, that's that old, you know, I have a guy that lives on my right shoulder. His name's Freddy the Fucker, and he whispers crazy stuff. And this friend named Louisa explained that to me. She introduced me to Freddy, and she said, you got to develop another voice, man, because that stuff's never going to go away. You know, some of the stuff we get gets given to us while the cement's still wet. And I mean, I still hear that stuff, only I just know it's bullshit today, you know. I have a whole nother voice that says, yeah, you know, he's full of it, right? So, I told him that I didn't think I was really wanting to do it and all that stuff. And he said, man, if you don't know what to say by now, you should just stay home. And he's kind of a cynical, grumpy old man just like me. There's been a lot of things that happened to me out there when I was using. I went to jail in Juarez. I was there for 17 days. That wasn't very much fun. I've been to jail a number of times. And I kept going back. I mean, it was terrible. And I was unable to affect a change in that behavior no matter what I did. I tried acupuncture, and I went back, got my money back because I got sick, you know. That poor guy, I thought he wet his pants. It was terrible. He couldn't give me back my $35 fast enough, man. I chanted Nam-myoho Renge Kyo in basements of many churches. I had hands laid on me. I went to charismatic services, man. I went to, synagogues, all that kind of stuff. I'm kind of grateful that I was brought up without any indoctrination, because what I found is, truth's something you'll find if it's around, if you're looking for it, you know, and if you're not, you don't have to worry about any of that stuff. This program got to me after many years of, after I had given up, that people like me ever got clean. I have to tell you, I was in a place where I couldn't stop shooting dope, and I wasn't ever getting high, and I was either passed out or in deep pain. And it was because that woman I had been with, who got tired of hearing me say, you know, I'm going to stop, finally said to me, actually she went to my friend who was in another program and said, when's he ever going to stop? And he said, sit down. he's going to stop when you throw him out and tell him to never come back. And he'll either die or he'll get clean. But if you don't do that, I guarantee you, he's definitely going to die. I had already been dead twice. When there was some really good heroin that hit the street back in the 80s. Somebody brought it in. Nobody told him about cutting that stuff. So I would check the obituaries in the morning, see where to cop, and I would go cop. And a couple of times I was rolled out onto the tarmac at Washington Hospital Center. The second time that happened, when they brought me back and I was hit with the Narcan, I went into withdrawal. First thing I did was I hit the first person I saw, which was the doctor who just saved my life, and then they arrested me for assault. That's true. And in the beginning, when people talked about spirituality, I was the jerk in the back that would say, what's that got to do with shooting dope? You know, I mean, I just don't understand why this is something I have to know. I just want to stop trying to kill myself. And they said, yeah, well, you know, sit down and shut up, and maybe you'll hear something that you can't unhear. And that's really what happened to me. I went to meetings while I was so scared to not go to meetings, and I heard stuff. I don't know, I must not have been looking or listening, because it osmosed in, you know. My sponsor came to me at my first Narcotics Anonymous meeting across the street from NIH, where I got clean. I had been to Montgomery General twice. The third time I called Norman, he said, David, don't call me anymore, man. You're not listening. I can't help you. We were friends. I mean, we played poker on the weekends and stuff. But he couldn't help me because I wasn't listening. And And I thank God for the people that never gave up on me, because I had given up 7 years before I got clean. I lived in my car behind Ben's Chili Bowl. When I got clean, my sponsor came up, gave me his phone number. He said, call me every day for 30 days. At the end of that time, we'll talk about whether you are willing to go to any lengths, because if not, I'm not going to waste my time. And I said, man, that's kind of harsh. She said, man, you know, if I'm talking to you and you're not really serious or willing, you're taking time away from somebody else that might be willing, but will die while we're waiting to get to him, you know. I don't know a whole lot, you know. The longer I'm here, the more I'm certain that I have to learn. I was a big mouth, loud mouth, know-it-all that couldn't ask for help, and it almost killed me. But in the end, when I came out of that blackout in Paw Paw, West Virginia, I don't know how I got there, I heard a rumor that my mother got sober, and I knew that was impossible, so I called her. I called her on the phone. I hadn't talked to her in 4 years. There was a restraining order against me. We hated each other all our lives. My mother blamed everything in the family that was wrong on me, and vice versa. And so, anyway, I called her on the phone, and in the first couple of minutes I was talking to her, it was clear she was sober. I said, dang, maybe it's true. And she said she had been through a program at NIH that was based on family genetic studies they're doing, and I might be able to get in since I'm broke, unemployed and homeless. And so I got in, I didn't want to get clean. On the form it says, what do you hope to get out of this program? And I said, I hope to stop wanting to die, and that's all I wanted. I mean, if I had gotten that, anyway, something happened. They took me, they said I had to go to across the street to Suburban Hospital to an NA meeting, and I said, I don't think so. And they said, well, you're gonna have to leave. I said, what? Said, yeah, it's a required part of this program, and thank God, because what happened that night is I went to a Narcotics Anonymous meeting at Suburban Hospital. A guy named Chris Papps was leading this meeting, a guy I used to run with, who I bought lots of dope from and used like me, and was certain was never going to stop. And he weighed 50 pounds more than the last time I saw him, and he had teeth. I know that it sounds funny now, but that was really significant for me, because I had lost all hope of people like us ever getting clean. I didn't know anybody that got clean on purpose. Not one. I mean, in Lorton it was easy, but anyway, the long and the short of it is, this guy that gave me his number at that first meeting was another friend of Chris's, and after the meeting, by the way, they sent me to programs, the other one for, I don't know, 17 years, because I got 4 DWIs. I kept getting drunk and driving my car. So I hated meetings. I was sure there was no help for me in 12-step programs. It was the last thing I tried. My mother went for 10 years, never got sober, had a resentment because they couldn't add up all the time she was sober and call that her clean time, so she stopped going. When they told me I had to go, I said, okay, I'll go, you know, I hated it. So at the end of the meeting, I went up to Chris and I said, so what's this about? Because he looked happy. And he told me a couple things that I'll never forget. He said, I've known him for 25 years. He said, David, if it wasn't better for me in here, I'd be back out there. And that's the first thing I ever believed in any of those goddamn meetings. You know, nothing happened, nothing changed dramatically. I still hadn't slept. It was 10 days. I was seeing things and stuff, but I went to another meeting, and then I went to another one. This guy named Warren, who had given me his number, I didn't have a car or a license, picked me up. And for most every weekday for the first 5 years, he took me to 5th and K downtown, because that's where his home group was. And I met some people, but the first time I got there, man, you know, I got out of the car, and this place is above a liquor store. There's a big flight up, and at the bottom of the stairs, there's a little sign that says, check your ego here. I said, I don't know about all this, you know. There weren't a whole lot of NA meetings, but there were enough, you know. So when I was back out at home in Maryland, where I was living at the time, I went to meetings out there. But my sponsor was going to meetings at this club, and my grand sponsor, Al Wood, is the one that really helped me a lot, because Warren was crazy, and he still is, but he's still my good friend. He ended up being the best man at my wedding. Anyway, what happened was that girl that threw me out after I'd been clean and sober for a little while, ran into the grocery store. We started going out, and we ended up getting married. We were married for 20 years, and had a couple kids, you know. Anyway, that club, you know, his home group was a 10:30 Sunday morning coffee class. And we'd go down there every Sunday, and it seemed like most people there looked like they were going to church. And it was interesting because, you know, I'm a white guy who at the time had lived in Chevy Chase. My father was a doctor. And I away from home for less than 12 months, I found myself in an adobe building in Juarez, Mexico, with a guy with a shotgun and a pouch with a bunch of different colored balloons, you know. I got arrested at the border with balloons in my mouth. It was a disaster. I was a disaster. I got arrested in D.C. for something, and then I got out of jail. And the next day, I ended up in front of the same judge, man. And he just shook his head for like 5 minutes and said, Mr. Cohen, you're like a heat-seeking missile for the gutter. I mean, you're out less than 24 hours, and you're back in front of me. And I told him I must like it, and, you know, I don't know. You know, it's all funny now, but at the time, I was not having any fun. And at the end, I really was trying to stay clean. I could not. I tried everything, like I said. So Warren and I were going down there, and my first convention happened early. I got a call and said that my friend Carmelita had gotten me an indigent package, so we were going to New Orleans. So get ready, we'll be there in a half an hour. And I went to New Orleans with my friends, Doreen and Carmelita and Mark Lyons and Arthur Rush and all these people that I accidentally fell into the middle of. I mean, it was so unlikely, you know. When they took me down to the meetings downtown, most of the time I was the only white guy in the room, or maybe a couple. And with me and my sponsor in the room, we were the only two Jews every time. And I had a lot of problems with those guys down there because they really knew what they were talking about, and I didn't. But none of the problems I had with them had anything to do with what color we were. I learned exactly the exact nature, the unconditional nature with which we're supposed to accept each other. And, you know, they didn't have any problem telling me to shut up and sit down. It had nothing to do with me being white. You know, it had to do with that. I was a big mouth asshole and didn't know when to shut up. So, and I needed somebody to tell me to sit down. And they kept telling me I would hear stuff that I couldn't unhear, and that's really what happened, because I really wasn't trying to get clean. I was trying to you know, get my oil changed again. Anyway, after a few months, I had to go to court on a charge, and my sponsor and my attorney were in the program, and they said, well, don't worry about it. Just go in there and tell the truth. I said, what? I've been in court all my life since 16, and I'm 34 now, and I've never been in, well, I've been in jail, but not really long. So I went in there and I told the truth, and I had people crying in the back. I heard, you know, and the prosecutor stood up and said, Your Honor, the court is very moved, but we have in front of you, I mean, I have a list of charges. You know, I hung lots of bad paper in D.C. I had 13 counts of distribution. You know, it's just a long thing that doesn't really need to be delineated here, because you all know, none of us here got here by being fine, upstanding citizens. And, you know, I like to hear people say, I earned this seat. You know, I'm a little confused, because what I earned was a 6-foot hole and a cage. And I got both of them. You know, just to shorten this thing up, I'm a cancer survivor. I've had a heart attack. Both my parents have died. I got divorced. I got my shoulder's titanium. I have a new coronary artery. I mean, I'm getting younger because they're replacing parts, you know. Nobody's buying it, but I, you know, it works for me. My life is a huge pile of unearned gifts, and trust me, I didn't earn any of that stuff. You know, my son likes to ask me every now and then, Dad, you still need to go to them classes. I said, yeah. He said, how come you still have to go? Didn't you get it yet? You know, shit like that. So I told him what my... I had a sponsor for a long time, 15 years, named Tom, and he used to say that I come here to get the difference between what I came with and what I need to stay alive, period. And I don't know what that is. All I know is I don't have it when I go, and I have it when I come home, period. And that's really as detailed an explanation of that as I can come up with, you know. I don't really know what it is, and I'm glad I don't, because I would try to figure out. Another thing, thank God there's no advanced NA, you know. Because I'd have gone there first, been elected president, and I'd have been going out, and I'd be dead. So, you know, there's a mountain of episodes over and over and over again, all of which are the same that I'm not going to repeat over and over again. But whenever I thought I had a plan, instead of moving me in the direction I thought it might move me, it always seemed to end up moving me in the other direction. And, you know, if there had ever been any successes with the kind of thoughts that I had, I probably would have stayed out there longer. But at the end, I was certain I was never going to get clean, and I was going to die in the gutter behind Ben's Chili Bowl where my car was up on blocks. And, you know, I did not want to die that undignified death of a dope fiend. You know? I just wanted to not be there anymore, you know. My life was providing me with far more pain than death could possibly provide me with. It just seemed like a reasonable thing to do. And what happened that night is I put a big hole in the roof of my car. I missed. I couldn't keep my toe on the trigger and the barrel in my mouth. So I called my mom. I knew she had gotten close. I went into this program at NIH. I got a sponsor. I started working steps. And I got back with that woman, and I told my sponsor I wanted to go out with her, and he said, "You got to have the conversation with her." So the conversation. She said, "Yeah, you got to talk to her, explain that she's never going to be the most important thing in your life anymore, again. And that if she's going to be with you, she needs to be moving in the same direction." And I said, "Okay, well, that'll certainly ruin this, but I'll have the conversation." And you know what? She said, "Okay." And what's worse is she went to another program. And she got a sponsor with a black belt. I was not a very brave guy. I was a con man out there. You know, I would finesse you out of whatever I needed to do. But anyway, so I used to manipulate her even after I got clean and when I used to say, "Okay, fine, I'm going out to cop," and she would used to get upset. And after about 3 months of going to those meetings, man, I said that, and she said, "Well, do you need a ride or a loan?" So I knew that was over. And, no, but it was a good thing because, you know, we ended up creating a really good partnership that worked for 20 years until I got really sick. You know, I've had a lot of success and a lot of failures over the time, you know, but it's all material stuff, you know. At one point, my first job I got because I asked a guy to be my sponsor, my friend Lou, and he said, "Well, I can't really be your sponsor because probably have more time than me. I went out last night, but do you need a job?" Well, I said, "Yeah, I need a job too." And he said, "Look, go on down to the Wiz at 12th and F. We're selling records. Come on down." So I got a job with him. I worked there and at Iverson and at Rockville. And he and my other friend left to open their own chain and down in Richmond, Virginia. And they asked me to go, and I was getting ready to go over to Whole Foods, which was just getting ready to buy this company I was working with at Fresh Fields. And so I stayed, you know, and I started working for Fresh Fields, and I was doing well. I became a general manager of a store and all that stuff, you know. I've always been able to do that stuff, but it's always the management of taking care of me while I'm also doing what I need to do. I always convince myself somehow that whatever problem I have, it can be fixed with money. I grew up in Chevy Chase, where most people have more sense than money. And for part of my life, when people asked where I was from, I would tell them Wheaton, because I didn't really like anybody where I lived. I almost was ashamed of it, you know. But now I'm okay with it, you know. It is what it is, and it ain't what it ain't, and my life unfolds just the way it's supposed to without my help. Anyway, you know, I did that. I left Fresh Fields. We went to Richmond. We opened some stores. I went down, and there was three. 3 years later, we had 23 in three states. My company did great. And I got this phone call from my wife at the warehouse. She said, "Your son just asked me what we had done so bad that made you so mad that you stopped coming home and eating dinner with us." You know, I didn't come in here to be some spiritual guy, I got to tell you. You know, I just wanted to stop wanting to die. And, at that moment, I realized that yet again, I had become twisted up about what's important. You know? I have a daughter who went to meetings with me a lot in the beginning, and she'd tell everybody she was an NA baby. because my mommy wouldn't have no babies with my daddy till he got clean. So I'm an N.A. baby. And now I got an N.A. grandbaby. Last week was my birthday, and which is why I've missed this convention so often. My birthday is April 14th, and last week I turned 65 years old. Astonishing. Anyway, at the end of that record store deal, when I came back to D.C., I started getting really sick. When I was in Juarez, I got on Cinco de Mayo, I went to the shooting gallery as I did every day, and the pharmacy was closed. And I went and I used the House Works, and that day I got hepatitis. That was in 1970. And anyway, it takes a long time for that stuff to mess with you. It's a bad, bad virus. Lots of people have it. And, anyway, so I came back to D.C., and because I was got clean at NIH, there were these protocols they were doing with interferon. So for the next 6 years, I did interferon. Three protocols back-to-back, something I swore I was never going to do. I had a good friend of mine do that a couple of years before that, and they took him off his roof with the hook and ladder. He was getting ready to jump. That's bad medicine, man. It turned me into a depressed, suicidal jerk who most days were good if I didn't have to talk to anybody, because I would hear things being said and say, who said that? Oh, my God, it was me. You know? I was just not fun to be around. My fingernails hurt, my hair hurt, everything hurt. It was bad. Anyway, the long and the short of it is, after 6 years, they called my wife in and said, look, this last round was unsuccessful, and you've got hepatocellular carcinoma. It's a non-survivable cancer. You're going to die. They said that you got about 3, maybe 6 months left, and Mr. Cohen, we can't see any statistical basis to make you optimistic about this. You're not going to make it. And, you need to get your affairs in order. You need to make up with your brothers and get them to watch those two young kids you got, because you're not going to be. You got about 3 to 6 months. You can get on the liver list, though. That's the good news. You're finally sick enough to get on the liver list. And, I had a guy say, look, just do what you got to do to get on the liver list. We'll keep you busy while you're waiting. So I did. And this lady, Linda, that I worked with, you know, the coordinator, the transplant coordinator, says, look, you know you're not going to get a liver, but you just have to be in the line in case a miracle happens. And 72 hours after I was listed, I got a call saying, Linda said, look, I know I told you weren't going to get a liver, but you're the only one with cancer with your blood type, and there was an accident outside, and I got a liver. Oh, and that's just the first one. I mean, what's happened to me since then is statistically improbable, to say the least. I got this liver. It was a non-cadaveric liver, which means it was from a living but brain-dead body, which is really rare. This guy was in the center of this theater, surgical theater. There was 5 gurneys. I was on one of them. He saved 5 lives that night. You know, 2 kidneys, a pancreas, a liver, and a lung all got harvested from a live body into live bodies. It was bizarre. It was like science fiction. And that's God trying to tell David that just in case I thought I was in charge of anything. Because, you know, I used to like to think I was. And now today I'm really clear, you know. I don't get to pick what happens in my life, you know. And I didn't get cancer because I stepped on a crack on the sidewalk on the way home from elementary school. I got cancer because life is random. I went to a big meeting one time with some guy with lots of time, and he stood up and he did this and he sat back down. Man, that's crazy. That was worth the drive, right? It was Clancy in this other fellowship, because he was, you know, Mr. Big, and he said, man, look, life is like this and it ain't personal, and once you figure that shit out, it's okay. And that's the other thing Chris told me at the next meeting I saw him at. Because my shit was fucked up. I had sentencings coming up, and I ended up going to jail with celebrating my first year inside. He said, man, I don't care what you got going on, man. If you don't use, man, it's going to be all right. And I think I was waiting my whole life for somebody to just tell me, man, it's all right. You probably came with everything you need. You just got some bad information. Just sit down, sit on your hands, wait. It's going to be okay, man. And he had no basis for that, but he was right. My life has unfolded flawlessly. unless I decided I needed to get in there and fix it. And then things go south real quick. So, there's a lot of what happened in between. But what's really amazing, I mean, a lot of stuff happened to me, you know, I got sick and all that stuff, and Juarez and all that. But the worst stuff happened since I got here. A month after my transplant, I found out my wife had a boyfriend. 20 years we're married, almost. So I called my sponsor, left a message, calling her all kinds of names. Dagging, I'm in the hospital fighting for my life and blah, 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 blah. And when I finally got him on the phone, I started out, you know, just, you know, he said, David, I'm hanging up. I want you to call me back when you want to talk about you, because I don't sponsor your wife. And thank God, because I was starting to get justifiably indignant, something none of us can afford, man, you know? I've been told stuff that was so totally the opposite of what I was getting ready to do that I now am conditioned to clearly understand that I didn't come with the information I need to stay alive. Every moment of my life before that first NA meeting is evidence to clearly indicate. I mean, there's a couple of things I assume about people if I meet them in a meeting. One is that there is at least one area of everyone's life in that room that they've been a dismal failure in. And that is what to do next to make my life better. I mean, I wouldn't have had to come into these goddamn meetings and talk to you people and have you guys tell me what you see, because that's the key to this whole thing. You know, people, you know, I've got a few years and I still go to meetings pretty much all the time, and some people ask me why. I say, because, see, when I go to a meeting, I have people in my life that come and tell me what they see, and it's never what I see when I look in the mirror. Nobody in this room sees what I see when I look in the mirror, and that's the beauty of this thing. It's like Liar's Poker or Indian Head, if you ever played that. You know what everybody else's hand is, but you don't know what you've got in yours. I had a sponsor and sponsor and a grand sponsor that heard my fifth step. My job up at the club was to pick up ashtrays for a while. I didn't smoke, so I was kind of a whiner a lot. So I was whining, and Al put down his shit and came over to me and took me out the side door where there's a little tiny balcony. He said, "Man, we are so sick of hearing that shit from you. Everybody in that room has told you that you're wrong. And either we're all liars, or you have it wrong, David. And we really don't like being called liars." And he went on, because I said, "Oh, come on." He started calling me names that he would only know because he heard my fifth step. I was getting really mad. And this was the moment when things started to change for me. He started calling me all kinds of names, knowing what was really going to hurt. And I was about to hit him. I mean, I'm serious. And he's an old black guy, man. I probably would have killed him. But he said, "Stop, man. I haven't said anything to you that you don't say to yourself every day." Took a little bit of the wind out of my sails. And see, that's the thing, man. I have a sticker in my mirror in the bathroom at home. It says you're now facing the biggest problem you're going to have all day. So anyway, when I found out I had cancer and I was going to die, I called my sponsor and he said, "What do I do?" And he says, "I got no idea. No one's ever told me that." So, but I bet if you go to where you got clean and talk to those guys whose noses are still running and are wearing the wristband, on the way home, you won't feel as bad as you did on the way there. I said, "Bullshit." But I did it anyway. And of course, he was right. I went in there and I talked to, I can't tell you why. As far as I knew, I'd been told by, this was the last stop on the railroad, NIH, and these people were the, you know, experts in the field. I don't know why I felt better, but I did. You know, it's one of those inexplicable things that's magic in here. And there is, without question, magic in here. My standing here talking to you is proof. Anyway, so, you know, I got the wife thing going on, and then a month later I had this massive heart attack in room building 10 at NIH. Had it happened anywhere else, I'd have died, but they got me into the surgery and shit, and they did a triple bypass, and, you know, I didn't die. Although I did die on the table once, and, you know, I don't know how all this works. I just know that it works real well, and I'm still here to talk about it. I can't talk too much about it, but there's a lot of people who aren't here today that helped me. That like when I heard I was going to get a transplant, there were two people I called, Hal H. and Fast Eddie, and they're both dead. And I was in a program of 18 people, repeat interferon failures, and NIH that were trying novel therapies on people. Weird shit. None of it worked. But a couple of years ago, I got a call saying I was the last one alive. Nobody else survived. I've had to reconcile the idea that someone had to die for me to get this liver. And my friend Carmelita said to me one day, she said, look, you keep wondering about all this stuff, man. First of all, you need to thank God every day there's no justice. Because when I went to court on that fourth DWI, I got 18 months in jail, and I had 30 days to report to jail, which was cruel and unusual punishment for an addict. I was at a meeting whining about it, and she followed me out, and she said, David, did you do it? Did you ever do anything you didn't get caught for? You were in there whining about justice. You should kiss the ground every morning, man, and thank God there's no justice. And also, you know, that there, if there was real justice, none of us would be here. I'm really grateful that everybody here is here. You know, I don't know why. I was at a meeting one day and some guy said, you know the difference between the people that come in here and get it and those that don't, right? And he waited a really long time and finally said, me neither. and that's why I try to listen and do what everything that's reasonably suggested to me from people who have what I want. Because you see, they told me if you want what we have, you'll do what we did to get it. And that the mouth will say absolutely anything, but behavior will never lie. So if you want to know about me or anybody else in this program, it's not really that important to listen to exactly what we say. Just follow us around and see what we do. You know, at the place where I got clean, it was pretty regular. Somebody come up, and the first thing they say, so what step you work? Who'd you help today? My marching orders from the first day I went to that club was that I was supposed to go to a meeting and call my sponsor and help somebody and don't tell anybody about it. And that last part, man, is what changed who I believed I was. You know, it's really difficult to hate yourself as much tomorrow as you do today if you do something for somebody else and make sure nobody finds out about it. It's what I did when I was sure I was going to die and I didn't feel quite as miserable. You know, it's never failed me. If my new definition of what insanity is in my life is if I'm telling people I'm in a 12-step program to save my life and I'm not working any steps, that's as insane as it gets. I came here at a time when I was looking for a quick way out of my life because it sucked and it took a lot of drugs for me to be comfortable in the skin. And what I got as a result of that one day when they said, you got to leave or go to this meeting, is a whole lot of stuff that I'm certain I don't deserve. And to reconcile that, every day I've tried to do what they told me to do the first day I was down at the club, and that is that, you know, I call my sponsor every day. I called him before I came in here. And he told me, you know, if you don't know what to do or say now, don't bother. Just come home. And, you know. But I'm certain. You know, my friend asked me if I was nervous. I said, no, if I don't, you know. I'm too old to figure out how to lie about any of this stuff anymore. And when I used to worry about it, I didn't remember what I had shared afterwards. So I stopped worrying about it, and everything's really good. You know, there's a couple things that I've learned that were true for me, and there's promises in here. And there's one promise that Narcotics Anonymous makes to all of us. And the funny thing about that promise is that most of the time when I'm upset about something, it's got nothing to do with that one promise. Usually I'm upset about not getting my way or blah, 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 blah. And it's got nothing to do with the promise, freedom from active addiction. It doesn't It's not a country music song. It's played backwards. It's not going to get your dog back and your boat back and all that stuff, man. What you're going to do is you're going to be able to not use dope if you do. And down at my friend was very fond of saying that if you want what we have to offer, there are things you'll be willing to do. And to the extent that you're not willing to do those things, that's the extent that you're not willing to save your own life, because no one can do this for you. But once you decide it's what you're going to do, no one can stop it. That's the deal. And it's not complicated. My instincts are to complicate stuff because I got a couple brain cells that are still talking to each other. I don't know how. And make things so complicated. And the fact is that if I remember that I was unable to fix any of this stuff for 17 years trying to get clean, and that I have to go to a meeting for someone to tell me what they see so I can reconcile what it is I think I see, I have a good day. You know, somebody said once that the only thing the same is that it isn't for any of us. The one thing is that it is the same is the solution. And no matter what you're here for, you know, I sniffed glue for a while, I shot dope for a while, I drank too much for a while. But whatever it was I did too much of it for too long and couldn't stop. And so if you're new and you got a problem and you can't affect any kind of impact or change on that behavior, we can help. My friend has a card. He said, it says, if you want to keep using, that's your business. But if you want to stop using, that's our business. And it's the only thing I know how to do right. If you like what you've been getting, keep doing what you've been doing, you know. But if you don't like it, you might want to look at what you've been doing, because there's a cause and effect relationship between what you do and what you get. I don't really think I need to go on and on and on. Lots of other stuff's happened. I've had a heart attack. I got divorced. I called my sponsor. What do I do? He says, well, to get through a divorce without a bunch of hemorrhaging, tell her she can have everything. God's honest truth. And you take everything she didn't take. And I swear this is true. I did that and I got everything I thought it was mine. We got divorced without attorneys. My attorney with this was one of my early sponsors, Bill. He said, he talked to us individually, brought me in. He says, you don't need an attorney. You don't disagree about anything. See, I was in a marriage and I just didn't consider whether I was happy or not. But when I had an opportunity to think about it, man, it wasn't hitting and sticking anymore for a long time. I was an asshole for 6 years. I alienated both my kids and my wife. And the irony is that I did that medicine for my wife and kids and drove them away. I mean, there's a lot of material for some blues songs here, but it wasn't a whole lot of fun. Wasn't a whole lot of fun to live. So anyway, there are two people in my life that at the time said to me, David, you know, whenever you get sick of that shit and you had enough, come on over. We leave the side door open. There's a room in the basement. Ben and Beth in my area. They took me into their family like I was one of theirs. Their kids were born on my birthday, and we had a great time for a few years. You know, when I got told about the cancer, I was fucked up and pissed off at everybody. God was on my shit list, and what, you know, I'd done what I was reasonably suggested for a long time. And anyway, I don't even need to go there. I was mad. That's all I'm going to say. And as a result of all that stuff, I learned that everything that happens to me is not like I think it is when it happens. You know. So lots of stuff's happened that I haven't even gotten to that I'm not going to. But the important stuff is that when I thought really things were like the end, like the cancer part, you know, cancer saved my life. I'd have never got that liver without that cancer. So when things happen, try asking, how do we know this is a bad thing? Because we don't. When I got divorced, I thought it was the end of my life. Oh my goodness. Definitely not the end of my life. We are so much better friends now with all that baggage out of the way, man. I can talk to her like a person. It's just amazing. I get so sure about how things are going to work out. And even though there's no record to indicate that I'm going to be right ever, but it's, you know, I like to say, I used to say all the time, I'm the most grateful person in the room. I've been dead four times, twice before I got here, twice after I've gotten here, after getting clean. And I got an NA baby and an NA grandbaby, and the best antidepressant I've ever taken in my life is spending time with my grandson. You know, I don't know how much time I used up or how much time I got left, but I think I'm finished. If you're here and you got something about your life that you don't like and you want to change it, you're in the right place. You know? Ask for some help. That's what we're here for. We can't stay clean unless somebody asks us to help. So, you know, the most important thing I ever do, ever, the most important thing I've ever owned, the most valuable thing I've ever had in my life, and I've had some stuff that was supposedly valuable, was my story, which is all the bad things that happened to me, all rolled up into a tool that could be used to maybe allow someone to believe that they don't have to die like that. Thanks.